What do you think of when you think of Hawaii? For most of you, it probably sounds something like this.
This paradise lifestyle.
One of the most beautiful places on earth.
View is arguably $1 million view.
Lush green waterfalls, that crystal clear blue water, white sand, it's absolutely gorgeous.
But Hawaii didn't always look like this. So what was it like before?
Hawaii as a nation of people, my parents, my grandparents lived there as well. A rainy part on the east side of Oahu. I grew up knowing the names of the winds and the rains of that place and the names of the mountains.
Hawaiian culture kind of emphasizes sustainable practices.
My love, that wells up in me and that inspires me to protect our places.
Today, we are going to reconcile these two experiences, bridging the gap between these people who visit, or outsiders, and the native residents, insiders. We'll take you on a thrilling journey across time and into the paradise islands of Hawaii. We'll begin this journey long before the bustling cities and massive resorts, delving into the impact of outsider groups and discovering how, as outsiders ourselves, we can visit Hawaii and other places in a manner that's both reciprocal and respectful. From the dawn of the Polynesian settlement to the clash of cultures brought by European explorers, we'll unravel the mysteries of this enchanting land.
I'm Neam Shah.
I'm Tenzing Junzing.
And I'm Nardo Stemelu. You are listening to Foreign Footsteps.
So grab hold of your compasses, tighten your grip on the helm, and get ready to be shocked, humbled, and amazed by the stories of the Paradise Islands.
We have a special guest today, an insider from Hawaii.
Aloha o mahina poi poi o hua pria ka omea ke ia no ka ua kaniko o he'eia. My name is Mahina Kaomea. I'm from He'eia on the island of Oahu. I'm a junior who's studying Native Studies and minoring in Environmental Justice.
And our second special guest is Professor Michael Wilcox, one of the few Indigenous faculty at Stanford University. He leads the Wrigley Program in Hawaii, which is an immersive in-person Earth Systems student program through the Doerr Sustainability School. He has a doctorate in anthropology and archaeology, along with personal experiences working as an intermediary between scientists and cultural communities. So together, we invite you to join us on this great adventure as we navigate the waters of Hawaii's past, present, and future. Picture this. It is over 40 million years ago. A fiery force deep within the Earth's crust surged up, creating a spectacle of molten rock and volcanic activity. The Earth's plates shifted beneath the Pacific, and one by one, 137 islands were born. Long before any humans stepped on its shores, these islands became a sanctuary of animal and plant life.
Fast forward to 300 AD, and a daring group of Polynesian voyagers from the Marquis Islands in Tahiti traveled across treacherous conditions. Eventually, they stumbled across the lush green forests, sparkling rivers, and towering mountains that had emerged over time. With an unwavering determination to survive, they settled across the island, cultivating fertile soil, establishing communities, and inventing new systems of governance.
They named this new place Hawaii, and the thing that I found interesting about their society is that they formed these intentional cultural communities where there was a person of each type of specialization, fishing, farming, fixing, and whatever they really needed, and in each and every group of people. So without any exchange of money, they actually created a thriving society that reached 500,000 people.
But that all changed in the era of European exploration and colonization. Hawaii saw the introduction of outsider groups like missionaries, colonists, and explorers. Alongside religion and crops, they brought traders to the island, and for the first time, Hawaii transitioned from a primarily trading-based system to a cash-based one. So as we look at Hawaii now in the 1800s, we're looking at a very different place than the cultural community-based one we saw at the beginning.
But there was another group of people that had started to come down to Hawaii, and they weren't missionaries. They weren't traders. So who were they? They were representatives from the United States, and their job was to scout out Hawaii, essentially to figure out if it was a strategic place for the United States to expand and set the framework for the U.S. to come down later.
And they found that Hawaii was very strategic. Matter of fact, Hawaii was called a crossroads of the Pacific, a perfect stopping point between the U.S. West Coast and the Philippine and Guam Islands in the Pacific. So in 1898, the U.S. annexed Hawaii, setting up military bases and flying down soldiers to train them to fight in World War II.
But wait, before we move on, let's get more context on the military in Hawaii from an investigative journalist.
Native Hawaiians, also known as Kanaka Maoli, have used this land for at least 8 centuries. But following World War II, the Army started training here. Since then, they've dropped bombs from planes, launched rockets from helicopters, shot targets with mortars and artillery, and left behind unknown amounts of unexploded ordnance, meaning bombs or ammunition, that didn't detonate after they were fired.
As World War II came to an end, and many members of the military returned back home, they started talking to their friends. They were like, you know that place I was stationed at, Hawaii? It was beautiful. Blue skies, clear beaches, yellow sand, delicious food. And as word spread and commercial airlines grew, tourism to Hawaii began to explode.
At first, tourism was great. People started building hotels, restaurants, golf courses, bars, and more to accommodate and entertain all these new people. For locals, this led to new job opportunities and chances for businesses to grow and earn money at a scale unimaginable before. In fact, Mahina describes how a local food truck found success overnight.
There's this random small Malasada truck that's parked in the parking lot outside of Windward Mall. And somehow, one year, it made it onto this list of top 10 things to do while you're in Hawaii, visit the Leonard's Malasada truck. People started coming, this huge buses of tourists, on their way around circle tours of the island would, stop in the parking lot. And all, 50 people would come off the bus and get in line to get Malasadas.
While the food truck may have found success more recently, this is symbolic of what was happening throughout the mid-1900s. However, the outsiders just kept coming and coming and then coming. And between the military and tourists, residents became outnumbered 6-1. And rather than growth, locals began to see other effects. Food prices, for example, were one consequence.
Buying food in Hawaii is like going to the airport and trying to buy groceries. A loaf of bread is $14. The average wage for workers is about $10 to $15.
And when you think about it, who is earning the majority of the money coming from all these tourists? It's the hotels, bars, resorts, golf courses. And who owns those? Generally, huge corporations and non-native investors that have the resources to open up shops in Hawaii and that can sell products for cheaper prices than any local businesses can afford to sell them for.
And as a result, so much of the economic growth of Hawaii did not help the native residents.
I didn't even realize the extent of it until coming to college. The Kanaka Maoli, a lot of the Hawaiians here, are actually from the diaspora because they were priced out of their homelands one or two generations back, and their parents had to move to California, to Oregon, to be able to sustain their families.
And the problem lies in the system itself. I mean, imagine owning a home. Would you want to rent it out to a local family who can afford to pay about $15,000 a year? Or would you make it an Airbnb, sell the land to a hotel or casino, or even rent it out to a rich family who wants a vacation home in Hawaii? The more outsiders that come to Hawaii, the more landowners inevitably make decisions that hurt local residents. And the cycle of harming the locals just continues.
Now, let's shift gears a little bit. As Hawaii became more accessible to people all over the world through tourism, people began to have questions. Questions about the unique environment of the Hawaiian Islands.
The position I'm in, it's called a boundary spanner, which means that you work as an intermediary between people who are interested in scientific or Western ecology. So we're looking at how people made a living off the land in a real technical, dry, scientific sense.
There have been huge investments in Hawaii to study the land, the animals, and the mountains, or even use the amazing conditions to be able to create new types of experiments and labs. And Hawaii has been the start of so much new research.
8,200 feet above sea level, on the desolate slopes of Mauna Loa on the Big Island, sits a geodesic dome, a remote habitat where the University of Hawaii at Manoa and Cornell University are performing groundbreaking research on long-duration space travel. NASA has awarded $1.2 million to the High Seas program to fund 3 more missions aimed at overcoming what the space agency calls red risks.
there have been some pretty amazing insights that researchers have been able to learn from Hawaii's diverse ecosystem, from mountains to the seas to forests. But the problem does not lie in the research itself. It lies in how we go about doing that research.
I'm thinking a lot about a moment that happened in 2019 during attempts to build the 30-meter telescope on Mauna Kea, which is a place that is sacred to us. It's the site of one of the largest aquifers on Hawaii Island, and it's the place that in our genealogies all of us come from.
We have to remember that researchers are still outsiders to Hawaii, and their actions do not necessarily always consider the interest and value systems of locals.
Scientists kind of thinks like, oh, these people are here for me to, like, they're objects of study or kind of subjects. That can be exploitative, and it can be extractive, which is the exact opposite of what people in Hawaii need because of tourism and the military and all the other extractive programs that colonization has brought there.
There's so much to be learned from Hawaii's diverse ecosystem and so many sustainable indigenous practices that we can adopt. But the first step in understanding and connecting with the local community can be missing in a lot of the research process. We can see that a lot of those pieces, colonists, military, tourists, research, have led to a Hawaii that looks incredibly different than the one indigenous people had in the 1700s. Based on what we've learned today, I would say that in a lot of ways, it's worse for residents and the environment. And these changes that led to today's society were mostly brought by outsiders. Outsiders who weren't trying to harm anyone, but rather brought progress in the way that they defined it to the land. So how do we shift our mindset as outsiders to align with what these insiders believe?
Let's think about growth. Western culture often defines growth in terms of GDP or money spent in Hawaii. And that led to a lot of the changes we saw in terms of tourism. But what are we missing?
If that's the goal, acquiring things, making things, producing things, extracting resources, the U.S. is the best. It's the best society ever. If you shift success from acquisition and expansion to sustainable systems, then the best people at this are those who lived in the same place and managed not to destroy them for thousands of years.
Just as Professor Wilcox is saying, our Western value system is based on extraction. This is completely opposite to how Native Hawaiians and other indigenous populations define success. If we want to improve society for everyone, how do we include other factors like culture, tradition, history, trade, and environmental recovery in success?
You won't believe it, but the answer has been right in front of our faces this whole time. Indigenous communities have developed a decision-making framework that incorporates all of these values that seem incomparable. They call it the seventh generation principle.
Indigenous people, we look at the natural world as an extension or a connection, is kin, literally kin. We are kin to the earth. We are responsible for taking care of the earth. And we are charged with the responsibility to create a sustainable future for future generations of people.
The seventh generation principle defines all of these factors, environmental recovery, house prices, jobs, by its impact on the next future seven generations. It challenges us to make sustainable decisions to keep our place safe and abundant for many, many years.
It's the idea that you're simultaneously an ancestor and a descendant at the same time. So we have to understand ourselves as having been put into this space by other people who aren't here, who we never met, and created opportunities for me to be here. So that's how indigenous peoples think about ourselves as connected in time in a very, very different way to land.
We've learned a lot about how outsiders have shaped Hawaii and how we need to shift our view and perspective to make Hawaii self-sustaining again for the people who live there and for generations to come. And we really want to emphasize one thing.
So it's not like an evil thing to people. Don't ever think that that's the case. If you're helping, they want you there. If you're trying to help and be helpful and you have some kind of humility, you're welcome there. Understand the history of the place. Get on YouTube, look at Hawaiian scholars.
By embodying these principles, you not only honor Hawaii, but you contribute to a future where Hawaii's beauty and culture continue to thrive. Specifically, next time you're in Hawaii, you can volunteer in taro patches, aid the reviving fish ponds, and learn the history of the community.
And this is not only for Hawaii. To me, this truly feels like the path to going anywhere as an outsider. Just recognizing that I can go into a new place with the goal of learning to coexist and grow together with the people makes me feel like part of something bigger than myself. It makes me feel like I can learn the place and the people like an insider, rather than making the place fit itself around me.
Thank you, guests, for this meaningful conversation. And to our listeners, thank you for joining us on this journey through Foreign Footsteps. Let's continue to learn, grow, and respect the communities and cultures around us. I'm Nardos.
I'm Neum.
I'm Junzing.
And you just listened to Foreign Footsteps with special guests Mahina Kaomea and Professor Michael Wilcox.
It's not a game. It's not a commodity. It's a life. It's people. And that shift in consciousness from, oh, that's a pretty thing, which is, oh, that's cool, to this is deeply personal, and it can transform the way that people interact with the world. Like, they have something there. It's a genius, and we can learn from that.
You've been listening to Foreign Footsteps, which was written and produced by Nardos Demelo, Neum Shah, and Tenzin Chosing for the Stanford Storytelling Project. Music from Descript and Pixabay, online clips found on YouTube. A huge thank you to our two special guests, Mahina Kaomea and Michael Wilcox. And thank you to Laura Joyce Davis and the entire Sound Stories class for your support throughout this process. Safe travels, everyone.